welcome to another episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman. Be sure to listen to the episode so that way you can get your two free CEUs. I am so excited for this guest, or these guests in particular, because they actually were on a previous episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. And what is really cool about, you know, these two guests, first of all, they're phenomenal people. I absolutely have loved getting to know them, following them on social media. But also, too, this episode, I think, is really important because we're about to dive into medical necessity, dosage, all the things that are just related to recommendation for treatment when it comes to ABA. So I'm really excited to reintroduce the Psychobabble BCBAs, Lauren Toby and Erica Ronaday. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us, Michelle. We are thrilled to be back, and there couldn't be a more exciting topic for us. This is one that comes up so much when we're meeting personally, so I am super psyched.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're happy to be here. And, you know, fun fact, Michelle, is that I think when we were on this podcast last time, it was our first podcast appearance as the Psychobabble BCBAs. So,
oh my God.
You're right. Yeah, absolutely. So we've now, it's been, I mean, just about a little under a year or over a year. So yeah, mm-hmm. We're just a full year after. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, because it was right when the book came
you're
out.
Right.
So mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Oh my gosh. That is so crazy to think about, but oh my God, what a journey, right? We've all been through a lot in the last year, haven't we?
It's been a wild ride. Yeah, it's great.
Yes, it has.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm really excited to get into this because this has been a topic that has really been hot button for a long time. And, you know, we're kind of in this like thing of, oh my gosh, what is the right recommendation? You know, people are saying, oh, 30 plus hours a week. Some people are saying, oh, you know, we have to think about the child. You know, there's a lot of different opinions. And of course, we all have our own. And I know that CASP recommends 30 plus hours per week for comprehensive ABA. From your guys' experience, does this guideline fit the needs of the learners that you have specifically worked with?
Yeah, I'll jump in a little bit with this one because I think it's so important to kind of frame this topic in terms of the historical context. So CASP, the Council of Autism Service Providers, their nonprofit organization, I think they were kind of started up in the like late 2010s, around like 2009, they released a white paper. And for those who aren't kind of familiar, a white paper is kind of something that is written. It does not go through a peer review process, but it is something that kind of many organizations, especially folks who are giving guidelines and things like that, they'll put out a document like this. And they put that out in spring of 2025, so just earlier this year, about the impact of treatment intensity and outcomes when it comes to applied behavior analysis. They recommended kind of a blanket 30 plus hours for what they kind of define as comprehensive ABA. And what's so complex about this recommendation is you really have to consider that we've only currently started to question whether that 40 hour a week paradigm is valid. Like within the last 10 years, I know that when Lauren and I, we were in grad school between like 2009, 2014-ish, and that was just the accepted understanding was 40 hours. And the reason why we have that is because of good old Ivar LaVoss. Shouldn't say good. That was meant to be sarcastic. I don't know if that came across in my tone. But we have to keep in mind that this paradigm was really just established because that's what most folks work in a week. So, I mean, it's really, you're going back to kind of the Ford assembly line, 40-hour work week. Oh, let's do 40 hours of therapy. There was not at that time a clear evidence-based decision about why 40 hours was selected. But because so much research was done through that kind of intensive discrete trial methodology, we just look back kind of on that as sort of the quote unquote gold standard. But now we're finally starting to kind of question that validity. And we kind of now have to look at, you know, we've got autistic learners who received services in the 90s, early 2000s, and they grew up to be autistic adults. We are hearing from them now, and we are now realizing that along with many other things in our discipline, there is a large potential harm from 40 plus hours of therapy in a week. And we'll dive into a lot of that. The research base has a lot of conflicting evidence. And we really kind of see two camps falling out. So we've got those who question the paradigm and those who don't. So we've got to think about that. We've got to think about how the autism mandate, how the kind of like from a legislative perspective, the 40-hour paradigm was what drove the autism mandate to be passed in all 50 states. Lauren and I spent a good chunk of both of our careers in Indiana, which was one of the first states to kind of pass the autism mandates. And that was just accepted as the standard. We have to blanket provide 40 hours. That then drove a lot of the private equity decisions. And now we kind of have so much private equity that's kind of flooding the ABA discipline. And outside investors are in control of a company. They're also these for-profit models. They're increasing company value. They're looking to turn around within, you know, just a couple of years. And those decisions are often based on the understanding that most, if not every child, has 40 hours. So I personally, I think Lauren very much agrees with me. I never think blanket recommendations, particularly for something as sweeping and large and as big of an impact as 30 hours a week, is kind of the way to go. I think that we always have to have individualized treatment plans, recommendations, and things like that. But I also recognize that there's a lot historically to kind of balance there.
Absolutely. You know, I know personally, I've seen a lot of people, or not a lot of people, but a lot of companies, they've almost like adopted this standard. And it's kind of crazy to me because I do realize the commonality was the fact that they were private equity for the most part. I think I've recommended 40 hours a week maybe twice in my career, and it was because the children were not in school. One of them was not in school. The other one, we gave them school support and home support, but also there was a lot of pressure to recommend 40 hours a week too. At that point, it was like, I remember specifically, it was at one specific company, and they were like, you know, they're the reason why like our money banks are full, you know? And it's like, it's so sad to look at it that way because children are not dollar signs, you know, children. And, you know, these are children that need, that need our help. But yet at the same time, 40 hours a week, that is a full-time job. Know, you can only imagine what it's like for that child to go through, you know, not only ABA, but, you know, all the other services that they probably need too. You know, ABA is not the only thing that's out there, number one.
Totally.
And number two, even if it is, you know, even though ABA is evidence-based, you know, at what point do we realize, okay, you know, this is too much for a child. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we talked so much about the role that development plays in this and how BCBAs often have gaps in their knowledge when it comes to child development and how those can be really opposing forces. So yeah, that's all things we need to be considering for sure.
Yeah. Well, and when you think too, Michelle, and this is something I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more as we go on, but you know, BCBAs don't get a lot of explicit training or instruction on, you know, how do we determine dosage and how exactly do we know how much therapy a child needs? So then when they get to these companies who institute maybe these blanket policies, or maybe it's not even a policy, it's just right, highly suggested, it feels like guidance. And a lot of BCBAs were looking for guidance. And so then it becomes easy to be like, oh yeah, no, this is what my company recommends, 30 to 40. So that makes my decision a lot easier because in the absence of something more structured, that's kind of what people have turned to. So I think it's it was a constellation of many factors that kind of led to this, like, oh, wait a minute, how did we get to this spot where all of a sudden we think every kid needs 30 to 40 hours a week?
Exactly, exactly. And you know what's interesting, Lauren, you brought up a really excellent point. No one gets trained on how to determine dosage when you first become a BCBA. I actually remember, I'm going back to a memory of an employer that I'm not going to name them. They were not a good employer to me. So I'm just going to leave their name out. But I remember I shadowed an assessment and I was asked, Michelle, what would be your clinical recommendation immediately after seeing the kid? Granted, I saw the kid for an hour and a half. And I said, I'm going to be honest, I don't know what my recommendation would be. I would need to write the report and do a little bit more research on the child and, you know, look at their like interview documents and, you know, kind of see like the results and everything. And then my clinical operations director at the time was like, we're going to recommend 25 hours a week. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, how did you come up with that? And, you know, and it's so interesting because it's like, and the child was young, that doesn't matter. But, you know, it was just, it was so interesting to me to see like how quickly, and I felt like, to be honest with you, she just kind of dug a number out of her head. That's what it came off as more than anything, you know? And that was a standard at that particular company. I have not had that standard ever since, but I've seen that before and I can definitely see like, you know, how it looks when it comes to just like, you're just pulling a number at this point, you know?
Yeah. And I think another part of this too, Michelle, and, you know, I think that it's something that we see not just in ABA, right? Like we, you know, it's kind of known in the literature as like the autism industrial complex, the way that this like intervention, any intervention is commodified and you kind of have that like capitalistic flair on all of it, of course, but it even coming from psych recommendations. So the process often going, you know, there's a psychologist or even a pediatrician that does the diagnostic evaluation and then you look to the recommendations and they sometimes give a blanket recommendation of 40 hours a week.
I've seen that too. In their reports and it's like recommended 40 hours a week. And I'll have parents who are like, well, my doctor recommended 40 hours a week. Oh my gosh.
How confusing is that for a parent? Like so confusing.
Oh my gosh. Actually, you know, you triggered another memory of mine from that same company. I remember writing a report for this one kid and the kid was very young. He was two, like maybe just turned two a couple months prior. And I gave my recommendation, you know, I wrote his report. I think I only recommended like maybe 15 or 20 hours at that point. I don't remember the exact number. And she goes, so my doctor told me that, you know, they would recommend 40 hours a week. So how come you're not recommending 40 hours a week? And I just remember like being on the phone a little frozen, but then I was like, so this is why I came up with 20 hours a week. Yes. You know, the way that I view this is, you know, yes, we have some skills and behaviors we need to work on. However, 40 hours a week is a lot for a young child. We can accomplish a lot in 20 hours without pushing, you know, pushing him too much. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was going to say, like, have you ever had that before where a parent will just be like, so my doctor said this, what do you think? Like, you know,
and it puts you on the defensive from the get-go at the start of that caregiver relationship too. Cause it's like, if you do have a recommendation that maybe is different, you know, there are all kinds of like micro biases that exist. You know, I think that oftentimes medical doctors get, you know, they hold a lot more power sometimes than behavior analysts or social workers or, you know, behavior technicians. I think there are like those power dynamics and hierarchies that exist there. And yeah, it oftentimes sets you off on a really bad pattern because you'll have parents who come in expecting that you're going to say 40 hours. And then even if you have a rationale for why you're maybe recommending 15, 20, whatever it may be, then you kind of start off on the wrong foot with that caregiver. But yeah, that's definitely happened a lot. And I think that they're, I think it's interesting because the CAST guidelines, the documents that they have at the end, they have like some supplementary documents, and it's kind of guiding how to have that conversation with parents. But I think it's important to note that that conversation goes both ways. Sometimes parents want a lot more, and sometimes parents are incredibly overwhelmed when you're recommending 30 hours. And I think that conversation needs to be tailored to the needs of that family and also the position the parent's coming in with.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I think, Erica, too, that's kind of the point with all of this, right, is individually tailored. Mm-hmm. With all of the discussions on, well, this research says this and that research says this, and, you know, here's a document that's just giving this blanket recommendation for all kids need comprehensive services, it's losing the power of what ABA can do mm-hmm. within that, because it is true. There are children who benefit from mm-hmm. 30 to 40 hours. So yeah. The point isn't that intensive ABA can't be helpful, because it absolutely is. The problem comes when you start just applying these blanket statements to an entire population. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the real message here is that it needs to be individually tailored, and we need to know if we're going to make a recommendation for 30 to 40, why, right? Why is that what this exact child needs versus a recommendation for 10 to 15? So I think that's what's most important, is that BCBAs understand and learn how to appropriately conceptualize, right? What does this amount of therapy look like, and what can mm-hmm. it do for this individual child based on the needs that we're seeing and based on what the family is telling us is feasible?
Absolutely. So it seems like, you know, over time, when it comes to like these historical benchmarks of 30 to 40 hour standards, it really seems like at this point, it's like, it depends on the child, but for the most part, you know, we really can make a lot more progress with less than 30 hours a week. But again, it all depends on the child. It's not a one size fit all kind of practice. You know, mm-hmm. what we do is so individualized. It is so, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, the ABA that we provide is tailored to them, not necessarily tailored to, you know, oh, you have to do 30 to 40 hours because these particular standards are what was set back in the early days of ABA.
Yeah, completely. It's a similar thing. What you just said, Michelle, reminded me, you know, some people hear ABA and they think that all we do is discrete trial. I view the 40-hour recommendation as a similar kind of analogy. You know, it's do we only do DTT? No. Do we only do 40 hours? Absolutely not. Is it a part of what we do, and can it be beneficial? Sure, but it should never be the whole picture. We want to make sure that we are incorporating all of the other wonderful technologies. And I think that a lot of this now comes down to, as Lauren was kind of bringing up, and you were as well, like, how are we training BCBAs to make these decisions? Because I think it's clear to see that we've got a lot of bias coming from the companies we're working for and their funding structures. So we need to make sure we're providing that education before our BCBAs are employed by someone who's telling them, well, this is just what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's really interesting. You know, I've been in enough ABA companies, I've company hopped a little bit, and I've definitely seen where, you know, if your child is not given at least 20 hours a week of ABA, then they should not be a recipient of ABA from our company.
Yeah.
And I think that is such crap, to be honest. Mm-hmm. With you.
Mm-hmm. Right there with you.
Yeah. Like, you know, how can you say, oh, well, your child has to receive a minimum of 20 hours a week in order for them to benefit at all? Like, mm-hmm. really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how these, like, I've worked at companies too, Michelle, where it's been like the company policy that if they're attending fewer than 15 hours or 20 hours or whatever that may be, that they're then put on some sort of, it's like they're put on a professional improvement plan, like the family is put on a PIP, basically. They're told, if you don't show up, and I understand, I don't mean to I don't mean to sound like I don't understand the logistics of how these policies come about. I get it. I get that there is a business that occurs here. But when speaking from clinical decision making, we need to make sure that we're giving our practitioners the resources to make those decisions based on clinical factors, not just policy factors and company factors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I've seen the same thing, or it'll be like, you know, you have to receive a minimum of 80% of your recommended hours. Otherwise, we are just not going to serve you. Like,
that's literally
written. I've seen that written in treatment plans.
Wow.
It's disgusting.
It is. It is. It is. And I know, like, Lauren, you probably remember these days. I think, like, early on, because we both became BCBAs in 2014, and around that time, everything was medical necessity. So it was all framed in terms of medical necessity. It was like everything that you had to write had to be in that language, had to be in that term. And there were so many uncomfortable analogies being thrown around. So I think the one that sticks out to me the most is a company I'd worked for would say, you know, you have to compare this when you're talking to parents, you have to compare this to their child getting chemotherapy. And I was like, pardon?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, because, you know, it's like, you don't want their child, because again, this is all, it's all pathology paradigm. It's viewing autism as something that needs to be cured. It's viewing, you know, there is, you know, it's super, super ableist in the way that it is all kind of framed to these families. And that was the that was the big one, Lauren. I think that we probably had a very similar conversation with probably the same person. You know, that was how it was framed, is you need to talk to them about how you wouldn't deny a child their medication for their seizure disorder. You wouldn't deny them their chemotherapy for their cancer, is how this was being framed in like the 2015 era. So, yeah, that's a really scary thing to think about. And, you know, thankfully, I think Laura and I have both done a lot of unlearning about how damaging and dangerous those things are. But families live with these things that we say to them. And I think that that's, you know, what's stuck with me, and especially since becoming a parent, like, these things live with you. You don't just get to say it once and then it just sort of dissipates from that family, you know, sphere. These things have an impact, and your words matter, and you got to choose them wisely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important to note too, you know, because so much of this debate centers around the literature, right? Especially recently, because I feel like after Lovaas, we had lots of research that came out, and everything supported Lovaas's initial study. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 to 40 hours, we're seeing great outcomes. And so nobody questioned it for a really long time. And then I think more recently, like Erica said, really within the last 10 years, and even more within the last five, mm-hmm. we've seen more studies come out that's like, hey, actually, we went back and there were a lot of methodological issues with some of these early studies. And if we go through and we actually look at randomized controlled trials, mm-hmm. and if we actually look at, you know, more rigorous methodological research designs, which we didn't have in some of those earlier studies, it turns out that maybe some of the strength of the results of those early studies weren't quite as robust as we thought they were. And the more recent studies have questioned that, and we actually have seen, well, hey, if we compare lower intensity ABA to higher intensity ABA, in some situations, we're seeing the same results with both groups. And so then it starts to beg the question, well, we know ABA works. Does it have to be 30 to 40 if you can get the same results with mm-hmm. 15 to 20? And mm-hmm. so I think we're starting to ask a lot more of the right questions now. And that's scary for some people, mm-hmm. And maybe some businesses. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I'm glad you bring that up, because, you know, looking at the research from Lovaas, looking at the research about, you know, the 30, 40 hour standard, you know, it is kind of amazing to see how we've evolved as much as we have when it comes to the dosage. We're definitely not 100% of the way there. I don't think we're ever going to be 100% of the way there. But even like when I first started in ABA, when I was first a BT, I remember a lot of my clients being there anywhere from 35 to 40 hours a week. And I remember just looking at my clients and being like, do you get time to be a kid? Like, do you get time to have fun? Like, you know, you're constantly in therapy and that has to suck. Like, you know, doesn't matter about how much pairing you're doing at this point. Like, you're literally in therapy for a whole day. And it's like, you know, I think about like my own experience, because you guys are aware of like my experience. Now I got lucky in the sense of my mom basically like being that person for me. Right. But again, it's like, I just imagine what life would have been like if I would have been placed in an ABA center and someone said, mm-hmm. oh, I needed 30 to 40 hours a mm-hmm. week of ABA. It's like, holy shit, at this point, like, what am I supposed to do? Right. You know, like, that's so right. much time. That's right. That's a full-time job. It's a
absolutely, full-time. Absolutely. And you have to also like balance this with, you know, especially when we're thinking about center-based therapy, you know, we're thinking about how many transitions a day, how many new toilets is this kid around? How many novel utensils are they having to be exposed to? You know, there are so many micro things that happen throughout the day. And not only that, but it's also when we look at, you know, child development literature, that time in the home is with family of origin and with caregivers is invaluable for attachment. You know, we also need to not forget about that part as well. And if we are requiring that 40 hours, I mean, even in, you know, early intervention, you know, in school programs, those aren't even full day programs. They're half day programs for a reason. because we also want to make sure we're balancing those adaptive things. And yeah, I agree. You know, when do you have that time to play and, you know, do those leisure activities? And yes, great clinicians program those things in, of course. But if we're automatically saying 40 hours, 30 hours, like, we're going to see some diminishing returns for sure.
Yeah, especially when we're talking about toddlers, right? I mean, toddlers. Because think about, you know, Erica, when you were saying early childhood programs are only half day, until like the last 10 years, mm-hmm. kindergarten used to be half day.
Good point.
Because we knew that even five-year-old kids couldn't be expected to stay and sit and attend and listen for 8 hours a day, mm-hmm. right? Even they needed to be up and running around and playing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's interesting how, and obviously that brings up, I think, maybe larger comments on society, but things have changed so much in mm-hmm. what we expect of children.
Absolutely.
And it shouldn't be any different for autistic children.
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not at all. You know, I couldn't agree more, especially, you know, we do see these programs that are only, you know, half day. Like, why are we expecting a five-year-old, you know, or a four-year-old to be in a program, an ABA therapy program for 40 hours a week when we see kindergarten programs that, you know, sometimes are 3 hours a day, sometimes twice a week for, you know, 4 hours, you know, it really ranges. And it's like, mm-hmm. Why aren't we thinking about that? Why are we looking at, oh, well, the CASP guidelines, I'm not trying to diss what they're saying, but it's just mm-hmm. like, why are we looking at this, like, there's this gold standard of 30 to 40 hours a week, but we're not looking at the child as a whole.
Yes, completely. No? And I think the place this conversation always comes up, Michelle, is naps. Right? Like I'm sure this has been the case for both of you. Like, there have been so many just like bananas policies regarding children falling asleep during therapy. Mm-hmm. And some of them to the extent of, well, you just got to keep them awake.
Yeah, you know, you can't bill.
We're talking about 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, like, developmentally, they need naps. Like, it's not something that we have the medical background or expertise as behavior analysts to say, no, let's skip this kid's nap. And obviously, as we know too, autistic kiddos have so many more sleep problems to begin with. So if we're not even allowing space for those kinds of things throughout the day, I mean, I think that was the time for me that it really kind of became clear, is when I got direction from a supervisor that said, like, yeah, you know, we haven't hit the billable minimum for that kid this week. We've got to wake him up. He can't fall asleep. And it was like a 3-year-old. And I was like, no. I'm not here for that.
Yeah. The billable minimum. This is going to turn into an explicit episode, but disrespect, fuck the billable minimum, because, you know, I'm so sick of hearing that. It's like, oh, you know, this kid got 80% of their hours. Fuck that. Like, sorry, you know, kids get sick. Kids need to sleep. You know, I've seen, just to give you guys an idea. So today is August 24th. Last week, a lot of my clients started school. Yeah. So that would be August 18th-ish is when a lot of my clients started school. And believe it or not, they're tired. They're tired from sitting all day. They're tired from learning all day. You know, some of them, I don't know what every single one of my clients' classrooms look like, but, you know, it's so chaotic to me because, you know, like, we're just expecting, oh, we got to push. We really got to wake them up. Mm-hmm. And I think, unfortunately, some of that comes from this billable expectation, quote, bullshit. Yeah. But then, unfortunately, there's a lot of pressure on families, too.
Yes, completely. Yes. Completely. And I mean, it comes back to, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? It's like, if we've got hungry, tired, stressed out, exhausted children and families, it doesn't matter if we're doing the best quality therapy, like, it's not going to be beneficial. We have to make sure that those minimum needs are met first. That has to come first.
Facts.
Absolutely.
Facts. Like, you know, come on now, you know, like, how can we effectively provide ethical ABA and we're missing the very basic. It's wild.
But I get it too. It's like, I get that everyone in this system, from like the CEOs at the top to the regional directors to the clinical directors to the BCBAs to the RBTs to the kids to the families, it's like, I understand why people are making decisions these ways. We just have to make sure that we keep questioning it. And it's no one agency's fault. Like, it's the system. The system's broken. And we need to make sure that we're addressing it systemically and not just blaming any one of these individuals, because everyone is just doing the best they can at the end of the day. Let's hope. Let's give them that benefit and grace. But we do have to address it systemically, because it's a big systemic issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. Practice philosophical doubt.
Yes.
That's what I tell my students. That's what I tell other BCAs. That's what I just... Practice philosophical doubt. Just because, you know, we might say, hey, this is what our recommendation might be, doesn't mean you have to agree with me.
Yeah.
You know, you throw, and this is going to sound really horrible, but I am going to say this, you know, you throw, like, let's say you have a client and 6 BCBAs observe the client. We're all going to come up with a different recommendation.
Yep.
Just
it's true. It's absolutely true. And it again goes back to, like, we don't have standard practices when it comes to not just dosage, but titration, like figuring out what that optimal level of intervention is, because you can't just say it's 40 hours. Like, you know, you've got to kind of do a little wiggle room one way or another. You're going to have to kind of account for the fact that you're going to have to titrate up sometimes, titrate down. But we as BCBAs don't get any training in dosage, titration, how to make these recommendations, how to make these decisions. And that's a problem.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly. I mean, it is really sad. Like, I remember coming in as a BCBA, and, you know, like, one of the first things that I really needed a lot of training on was just report writing in general, but then just going to the recommendations portion. I still, almost 9 years into the game, have questioned that before. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how am I supposed to come up with this clinical recommendation when I have to look at not only, you know, not only like what their skill sets and, you know, their levels of support that they need, but then I have to look at their whole life, you know, their family values. I have to look at everything.
Yeah.
And it's how do you balance that? How do you balance research-backed intensity with family realities. What have you guys experienced with that?
Well, and it's case conceptualization, right? It's critical thinking. It's philosophical doubt, like you said. And I think some of those skills are skills that you don't necessarily have right out of school. And it takes time to really build that. And so that's where we need good supervisors. We need good professional development. We really need to boost the case conceptualization skills of BCBA so that they're able to question those things like you just did, right? It shouldn't just be about, plugged in some formula. I did the VB map and I think they need XYZ. I mean, it's also what's going on at home. What does mom and dad want? Yes. What are their values when it comes to therapy and the goals that they are looking for their children right now? So, and you have to take all of that and synthesize it to come up with what is going to be the best plan of care. And that is a really challenging skill. Like, that's not an easy thing to do.
Absolutely. And you bring up such a good point, Lauren. It's like we talk, we always remember to talk about social significance, but we often forget to say social significance for whom, because that's going to be very different. What the individual is going to want is going to vary from the BCBA, is going to vary from the caregiver, even between caregivers, that can really vary. And we know that being a caregiver to an autistic child leads to an unfathomable amount of stress. We are very well aware of that. That is well documented in the literature as well. But also just at being parents of toddlers, and I say this as a parent of a four-year-old, we're all maxed out. So when we it's an incredibly difficult season of life. If you're now adding to that stress level, okay, we want you to juggle 30 plus hours plus pack the morning snacks, the morning transition, the transportation, making sure you're having the comfort object, making sure you're labeling clothes, the bane of my existence, like all of these details, and you're adding all of those things, like you really have to kind of take a step back for a moment and consider not just the developmental phase of the child, but the developmental phase that the caregiver is caregiving in. Because I can't even put myself in that position of what those kinds of pressures would be like. And we have to keep that social significance at the forefront 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with that, especially because we do need to look at, what is socially significant for them. That's also something that I really try to teach my student analysts that I'm working with, is what's socially significant for one child is not the same as another child. Mm-hmm. And so if we're looking at things like, recommending hours, and we're looking at prioritizing things, when we're doing the actual service, we need to focus on the high priorities, because those are going to be socially significant for them in this moment. It might not be socially significant right now or ever to child Y, but to child X, it is socially significant for them, you know?
Completely. No, it's so true. And I think we often forget to do that. And we've got to remember we have to.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm going to go ahead and drop our first code word of the podcast episode. And that word is the word dosage. That is D-O-S-A-G-E. That is the word dosage. Now, let's kind of divert just a little bit, because not only, is there a lot of stuff about the 30 to 40 hours a week, there's also studies out there that emphasize early intensive ABA. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the timing. Do you feel it's more critical than the sheer number of hours, or what are your thoughts on that?
Lauren, I don't want to jump on you, but do you want to add or something, or you want me to hop in on this one?
You can start. Go for it.
Okay. I'll start. You finish. Sally Rogers has been working in this specific area for such a long time, and I'm a huge fan of her work. So the term naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention, NDBI, folks that might be familiar with stuff Early Start Denver model, you know, pivotal response training. There are many different names that this has gone by. Now we're kind of talking about the umbrella of NDBI. And really, it's kind of a term for flexible early intervention that incorporates ABA as well as other evidence-based practices. I think that this question really comes down to more of like a neuropsych concept. We're talking about neuroplasticity. Like, and that is a very well-founded phenomenon of when individuals are younger, their brains are still wiring and pruning, and there is a higher likelihood that that is going to lead to kind of exponential butterfly effects in the future. That's kind of what neuroplasticity is. So obviously, yes, but we also have to balance this with, this is true for almost everything. And the analogy that I always like to use with this one is like with language learning. If we're going to expose a child to a second language, it is much better for us to do that much earlier. But does that mean that they're not going to learn a second language later? No, just the pathways are going to be different. So obviously it's that same concept behind early intervention. Yes, earlier is better, but more is not always better. And that's where this conversation, I think, gets a little wonky, because I think that we equate earlier and intense. And it's almost like a marketing thing, early intensive ABA. Like, this is what we saw everywhere in the literature. Early and intensive went together. And I think it's important for us to separate those. We paired those terms, the high intensity and the early intervention together, but we weren't considering neurotypical child development. We would never expect a 3, 4, or 5-year-old to do 40 hours of schoolwork each week. We just wouldn't do that. And as we were saying before, you don't even do that in early intervention or in kindergarten. So I think it comes down to neuroplasticity. Yes, earlier is better, but also more is not always better. So we have to keep that in mind. That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it is interesting because, you know, there have been, and I think I referenced this earlier, but there have been more studies recently. One particularly, I know you mentioned Sally Rogers. Mm-hmm. She actually had an RCT in 2021 where they looked at two different levels of intensity. And they were all young children, so it was early intervention. But like you said, Erica, that was kind of one where the results were very similar, where everybody made progress in both groups. And so it was like, hey, yeah, the kids who got intensive therapy, they made a lot of gains, but so did the kids who didn't get as intensive therapy. So that kind of begs that question then, right? Yeah, early is good. It is going to hopefully lead to maybe some changes in those developmental trajectories because you do have that plasticity, but does it need to be 40 or bust? And mm-hmm. I don't think we know that answer for sure, but I think we have enough research where we can question the assertion that it has to be comprehensive.
Absolutely. You know, I can definitely understand that, especially just, you know, when it comes to early intervention, I see a lot of the time, I've seen it really more so like in the past where it's like we would push for more mm-hmm. because, again, gold standard in quotations here, you know, and looking at, okay, you know, we know that these 30 hours a week is going to absolutely make all the difference in the world. But the truth being told here, you know, did it really make that big of a difference? Just hearing, you know, hey, in both groups, in both comprehensive and focused, you know, we're seeing the same results are mm-hmm. still happening, you know, mm-hmm. doesn't matter about the hours.
Absolutely. And I think so much of this, like, this was a big reason why. So in our book, we had a lot of discussions as we were kind of just developing the idea of, should we have a chapter about group level statistics? And dosage was one of those topics that came up where I feel like we as behavior analysts do not receive enough training in how to interpret these group level studies. We get so much great training in single case design, but as Lauren's mentioning, like, randomized controlled studies. Do we as behavior analysts know the difference between a randomized controlled study and, you know, any other number of group designs? You know, we all probably had like a undergrad statistics course or something like that where we kind of like learned about p-values, but are we able to look at different research studies that are done at the group level and be able to kind of pick out those methodological errors, differences, you know, another one just besides the intensity of hours that Sally Rogers kind of looked at those. The other thing is like parent mediated versus like teacher mediated versus like behavior technician mediated. There are a lot of studies that kind of look at those differences. And I'm thinking of what you were saying about you with your mom, Michelle, too. It's like there are so many ways that we can parse out and look at this data differently, but it's essential that we understand the methodologies that we're reading about in a way that we can kind of discern like, oh, well, they actually didn't do this, or, well, we have to keep in mind that this is a group level. So all those individual differences are kind of getting minimized to those averages. So that was a big reason why we were like, we need to do that chapter as well. As much as people don't care for those kinds of chapters, I think it's essential that we learn how to do that as a field.
Agreed. I can definitely see that.
Yeah. And that's so important to point out, Erica, because with a lot of the early studies and even now, you know, one of the things that's very challenging is that every study maybe looks at outcomes a little bit differently, mm-hmm. right? So some studies are going to look at, well, the parents filled out the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Scales at time one and time two, which is a parent-reported measure of progress. And did they make progress from time one to time two? Then you have other studies that are maybe looking at standardized test scores. And then other studies that are looking at changes in autism severity symptoms, like ADOS scores. And so trying to put those all in the same kind of playing field to say, well, this study that looked at just the Vineland showed improvement, and that's the same as this study that looked at, you know, standardized test scores. That's like comparing apples and oranges. Yep. And so that's a very challenging thing too, where when you try to look at all the literature to do a good meta-analysis, it's very difficult to pull out similarities to be able to actually compare, to then have enough data to say, yep, we can say that comprehensive is best for everybody, or we can say that focused is best for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's been really challenging right now, because I think all the studies that are out there were all done very differently, and we just can't compare them all.
Very good point.
That is an excellent point. Yeah, you know, and unfortunately, it is very true. You know, it's like, how are we supposed to know exactly, like, what the best way to go about this is, you know? When it comes to recommending dosage, you know, how do you balance, you know, not only the guidelines, you know, and, you know, looking at research and everything, but also, too, thinking about everyone's unique needs, mm-hmm. you know, family values, the child as a whole, their developmental milestones and their age, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. how do you guys look at that?
You go, Lauren.
Well, so it's tough. And I think, I think it's important to mention, especially again, in the recent years, we've seen a lot more awareness around this, right? We've all talked about it today, how there just isn't any sort of standardized training for BCBAs on how to do this. And I think the field has recognized that. And so we are seeing this trend in developing decision-making models to help BCBAs make dosage determinations. And there's quite a few that exist out there. Some are very fancy, like AI-related programs. Some are maybe just a little bit more straightforward. But generally, these models kind of involve, you know, following a flow of inputting clinical information about the child into a document or on paper, and then looking at various variables in terms of, you know, autism symptom severity level, what were their scores on their, you know, standardized and criterion referenced assessments that you did, what is their age, do they have any co-occurring challenges happening, what is the family dynamic and, you know, the wishes of the family, and then you look at all those variables and synthesize and case conceptualize, and, you know, that kind of helps recommend a specific dosage level. And depending on the, you know, the fanciness of the tool that you're using, right? Sometimes it's just AI and it'll spit it out for you and tell you this child, you know, probably would benefit from XYZ. Now, obviously there's limitations to that kind of model as well. But I think what it highlights is that the field has become more aware of the need for some sort of a model to help guide BCBAs to making individualized dosage recommendations rather than this blanket, you know, everyone needs 40. So that I think is a better direction to move towards than and really helping BCBAs understand that each child has unique needs. Which means each child should receive a unique dosage tailored to them.
Say it louder, Lauren. Say it louder.
Seriously. You know, it's so funny. So I've actually seen a medical necessity assessment tool actually on an EMR platform that I used to do. Actually, you know, the company that I was at or the company that I'm at transitioned over. And I just remember filling it out and it was all deficit based, which obviously we're trying to move towards strength-based language, you know, I'm trying really hard to teach all about that, you know, stop looking at everything with deficit language, stop looking at, oh, well, you know, we're just going to tie back to, you know, the core deficits of autism, again, eye roll. But I looked at this specific medical necessity assessment and I looked at it, completed it for one of my clients that, in my opinion, was like ready to fade. And then it actually came up with more hours than he was already being recommended for. And it's like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, again, like they're not. And I think if I remember correctly, there was questions about like, does he go to school? And I also remember too, like just some of the questions on there, just all tied back to like stereotypical behaviors and all the things that like, to me, as long as they're being safe, who the fuck cares?
Sure. Yeah.
It's like looking at that, it's like, you know, if there is a medical necessity tool out there, if there is a dosage tool out there, please, like I'm begging you as an autistic person and as an autistic practitioner, please like actually make one that doesn't just focus on deficit-based language. It's disgusting.
Thank you for saying that because you're absolutely right. I don't know that I have seen any that do take into account strengths. They usually are deficit-based, and I think that's extremely important to point out. I also think, and I should have mentioned this earlier, a decision-making tool should never take the place of clinical judgment, right? Sure. It is an aid. It is a guide. And if you're in a situation like what you described, Michelle, you know, you go with your clinical judgment. You don't say, oh, well, the tool said 40, so I have to do 40, right? Yeah. Because again, even with, you know, something to help guide you, it is very important that, right, the tool doesn't know the things that you know about the child skill level or the family, right? Well, mom said this, the tool doesn't know that. So, be used, not replaced.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that, Lauren. And I think like, I'm gonna say something radical that shouldn't be radical, but ABA therapy isn't medication. Like,
thank you.
We need to, and I like hate that I have to say that, but if I was talking to myself 10 years ago, I would have been like, wait a second, but medical necessity. And, you know, I would have had a really hard time digesting that. But I think that we as a discipline need to keep in mind that the longer we are viewing ABA therapy as a treatment, the longer we are viewing it as a way to make autistic youth indistinguishable from their same age peers in the language of Lavos, the longer we are using that medical necessity as a guide to all of these things, which again, I understand why we have to do that because it's the way that the American healthcare system works. But in order for us to go to move to have a tool that would help us make this very medical, clinical, pathology-based decision, a strengths-based, we have to start looking at things in terms of mitigating factors, not just strengths and needs, but how are certain things mitigating things that are causing harm or that are difficult or that are leading to, you know, things that that family or that individual does not want to have in their life. And that is a very high level skill. I think it's out of my pay grade. Like, I don't know that I could figure out how to do that. Lauren, you might be able to figure out how to do that. But we have to, every time we're having a discussion about dosage, treatment intensity, we have to start that conversation by saying ABA therapy is not a treatment for autism. And we just have to keep saying that.
Yeah.
And that is so hard when you work within the insurance system, right?
Because that's literally what
That is what they ask you to do. And so it is so challenging as a BCBA to figure out how do I work within that system and then also provide the best care for my learners.
Yeah. We have one insurance funder that we work with at my current job that literally when I was actually the one that insurance was contacting, they would give me critiques about, oh, it has to tie back to the core deficits of autism. And I could roll my eyes to the back of my head with how frustrated those phone calls were. Because it's like, why does everything have to be the core deficits of autism? First of all, why are we using deficit-based language? Third of all, ABA is not just for autism, you know. Come on now, you know, like the program, you know.
And I hope, Michelle, like that there is a future, you know, 10 years from now where obviously we have like a different healthcare system first and foremost, but secondary, like that we are actually able to step away from medical necessity in many ways and that we are able to start making treatment recommendations based on clinical judgment and good decision-making training. That's really where we need to kind of hopefully go. I don't know how we get there. I think there's a lot of things to consider, but I think it definitely needs to start with, you know, we've got to stop trying to cure autism. That really is where we need to start.
Yeah. We need to just truly embrace, you know, our clients for who they are. Mm-hmm. We're not going to stop every little thing that we might feel, you know, is socially significant for them to stop doing. We need, again, you know, this field is supposed to be here to help change the lives of our clients. You know, we're supposed to help increase their quality of life for the better. So why are we focusing on and nitpicking on, you have to do it exactly like this other neurotypical Johnny over here. You got to be in this little box. Otherwise, oh, you go outside the box. Sorry, you know, like, no, that's not how it should be. That's not how it should be. I mean, it's so bothersome. And especially just, you know, looking at like my own life as an autistic person, it's just like, again, you know, masking is definitely a big thing for autistic people. And, you know, and that's where a lot of ABA, the ABA's abuse arguments really, really come up. Is, you know, we're recommending masking high dosage hours, but we want them to be like neurotypical Nancy and neurotypical Johnny, as opposed to them as
who they are. Completely. And I would be super curious to see like how other disciplines, and I haven't looked into this a ton, but I would love to know how other disciplines have approached that interaction with insurance and have had success, because I know it has been successful, and we're talking about, you know, obviously other diagnoses and you know, other systems of support, but I think that would be a very interesting place to look to in terms of decision-making guides, and then also how to guide insurance in general when it comes to our sector forward more.
What's tough about that, though, is that there aren't any other disciplines that are asking for 30 to 40
hours. You're so right. You're so right. You're so right.
That's why there isn't a guide for this. Mm-hmm. And that's why insurance, you know, again, I'm not trying to like be on their side, but like they've had to like come to the defensive because it's like you're asking for
what?
Literally a work week for mm-hmm. these children in therapy. You need to tell us why mm-hmm. this is necessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like I hate to say this. I don't know if I even should, but it's almost like we did this.
I know.
Like,
yeah, we did do this. I mean, yes. Yes.
We caused this.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And again, it comes back to the autism mandates, and it comes mm-hmm. back to, you know, very fierce caregiver advocates who did amazing work to get to where we, you know, where we got. But I do think that I think that we're perhaps at a moment in history where we need to kind of pause and question, was the outcome that we received aligned to what our current values are as a field now, what we are hearing from autistic adults, what we're hearing from autistic youth right now. And yeah, I definitely think it's a time to pause and reflect. And that's what I always tell like my supervisees, if you walk into a situation and it's a mess and you don't know what to do, pause and observe. And I think we're in one of those moments right now when it comes Absolutely. To medical necessity and dosage for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could not agree more. And honestly, pause and observe should actually be like an actual mantra in ABA, just because we're pause so quick to yes, fix do. Things and change and do. Yes. And it's like, why can't we, take a second to yes. just like look at what's going on here.
We were just speaking at a conference earlier this summer, and we were talking about consultation and collaboration, and just talking about like the decision-making process and the consultation process. And I just kept saying this over and over. If we jump to the third step, which is implementing an intervention, before we have a good idea of what the problem actually is, we're doing no one favors. Like, this is good for no one if we don't have a good idea of what we're actually trying to accomplish. And I think we're at a crossroads in our discipline right now where we actually don't know what we're trying to accomplish. Exactly. I think we were really stuck for decades on we're trying to fix autism. And now we almost don't know what our replacement behavior is. I mean, obviously it should be to improve the quality of life for these folks that we work with and the systems that surround them. But I think that it's almost too morally ambiguous for people like hang their hat on. So yes, let's pause and observe, figure out what we're actually trying to fix before we jump into fixing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, and you mentioned the replacement behavior for curing autism. I mean, it's so true too. And it's like,
we need something else to do with our hands. Yeah. Like we do.
Right. How about you sit on your hands for the next 2 hours, you know, like, oh my God, I cannot. And, you know, here's the other thing too, right? Like we're looking at this, but then we also look at, you know, research rarely accounting real world barriers, right? Mm-hmm. Think about stress, think about transportation. You know, some of our ABA centers out there only want center-based services, no in-home, because, you know, fuck the in-home people, right? But I've since left those companies because, again, center-based ABA only for me. This might sound, hopefully this isn't too controversial, but we need generalization. So why the fuck are we just doing services in a center? But that's a whole other vet for a whole other episode.
For next time.
You know, how much should those factors influence the ideal hours that you might recommend? Ideal being air quoted here.
Yeah.
You know, because again, there are real world barriers that happen. Think about environmental variables.
Exactly. You know? Absolutely. And I think, like, you know, Lauren and I were both trained as school psychs, and we very much were, and I would say we probably both fall into this camp, Lauren, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we're both like developmental ecologists at heart a lot of the time. Like we look at things in terms of kind of like concentric circles of support. So when I think about making recommendations, I always am looking at the child at the core, and then we're branching out to the family, then to the community, then to the government, then to insurance. And that, you know, those are kind of the tiers in which an individual exists. So I think that when it comes to building therapeutic alliance with families, which honestly needs to be so much more of an emphasis of what we do clinically, we have to consider those things at the forefront. Now, should that necessarily impact the recommendation that you're making completely? No, that's not what I'm suggesting. But we have to think about things like, how are they getting there? I'm going to share just for a moment, like something I didn't realize, because I worked at the start of my career. I did a lot of work in Washington, D.C. With the bilingual Spanish speaking community and a lot of immigrant population there, too. I would suggest that they would go to their insurance provider, because I knew that their insurance provider could give them transportation. What I didn't realize is that the caregivers were not allowed to go with their child. So oftentimes they would be putting a three-year-old in a taxi with a stranger.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
Insane.
And I mean, wild, like so wild. And like, obviously most of the parents were like calling me and like, I'm not doing this. Like, thankfully, like as they should have. But when you, I think so many BCBAs are like kind of maybe, you know, due to a variety of factors, not thinking about things like, hey, if that family doesn't have a car, that individual doesn't have a driver's license, not only are they not going to make it to your center-based facility, but you are going to have such an uphill battle when it comes to creating that therapeutic alliance. And you have to keep those things in mind. And we just don't have enough knowledge and resources to really serve the communities that we're working with. A lot of times it's a huge knowledge gap for behavior analysts, particularly behavior analysts who maybe aren't from the communities that they're serving. I think we have a lot of gaps. So obviously once I found that out, I was like, whoa, I've got to approach this, you know, much differently. You know, we have to look to some in-home solutions. And oftentimes when you're working at like a center-based facility, that's just not an option. Like there isn't a, oh, we'll also do in-home if that's not part of the established program. So I think you have to kind of look to clinical decision-making from the child out. And obviously insurance is a further out concentric circle. But I also get that they're the ones that hold the power in this dynamic too. So it's a lot to manage. But you have to keep those factors in mind as you are having these conversations. And I think where that starts is in that initial interview with that caregiver. And you really need to get to know what the barriers are that day, that hour for that caregiver, because that is what you're basing that social significance on in that moment.
Yeah. Well, and if you ignore it, and that's and that's the key, because I've seen that happen so many times where the parent has been upfront, like, this seems like too much to me, or I have transportation issues, or, you know, at whatever it is, but yet that's ignored. The recommendation is pushed forward anyway. And then later, 6 months down the line, it's like, well, they're not coming. They have it's like, mom told you they weren't going to be able to come. Or, you know, it's not generalizing. Well, yeah, mom's got five kids at home. Like, she told you this wasn't going to work. So that is, I mean, we're not going to generalize. We're not going to have good treatment outcomes if we're ignoring those things because we think for whatever reason we have to push through this recommendation for a really high intensity. And those things, they don't mesh. And that's challenging, I think, for a lot of BCBAs for a variety of reasons. Like you said, Erica, I think there is a lot of pressure on many BCBAs. And so it's like, okay, yeah, I heard what mom said, but I know my company would like it better if it was a comprehensive recommendation. So we have to learn how to get away from that and connect with the families better and meet them where they're at.
Yes.
Because that's how we're going to get optimal treatment outcomes.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And I'm going to go ahead and drop that second code word. It is medical necessity. So it's two words. So it's M-E-D-I-C-A-L
space NECESSITY. So let's talk about the future, what dosage should look like in the next, you know, few years. You know, looking forward, do you think that, you know, dosage will kind of remain where it's like, you know, the 30 plus hours, you know, that's the again, quote unquote, gold standard? Or do you think that we're going to move even more or start to move towards individual precision based models? Like, where do you guys stand with that?
Erica, you want me to go first?
Yeah, go ahead. You're good.
I mean, I think we're already moving towards more individualized recommendations. I feel that in just kind of, you know, the buzz recently. I think we're seeing more published articles on how we should be more individualized, a lot more on parent-mediated intervention, which is going to generalize better and lead to better outcomes. I think that is the direction that many are moving towards. Obviously, we know, and we kind of talked about this, we kind of have two ends of this camp here where it's like 40 or not. But I do think we're moving in the right direction. I think, you know, autistic voices are speaking up. They're telling us about their experiences with comprehensive care. And I'm hopeful, right? I'm hopeful that we are going to see that trend. I also think insurance is going to contribute to this.
Yeah.
I think in many states right now, particularly where I'm at in Indiana, we are seeing insurance really question the comprehensive model. And I think that there are going to be changes in the next several years that might actually force us to look at lower intensity care. And this isn't going to be popular, but maybe that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we've seen that with TRICARE in particular too, Lauren. I think that we've kind of seen the writing on the wall a little bit in terms of the trend that insurance is kind of more and more looking for ways to provide less, which obviously this now gets into, and this again could be a whole other conversation about, you know, terminology use, the notion of quote unquote profound autism. You know, what about those individuals who absolutely do benefit from 30 plus, and we do not want those folks to be left behind. And then we also have to add into this, Lauren, you just did an article review on this, the reemergence of subtypes coming up now. There was a Princeton article that came out, was it like a month ago-ish or so? And I do wonder, and obviously there were reasons that subtypes were eliminated when we went from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5, and now they're kind of presenting, and this was just one study, so really just a drop in the bucket, they're presenting different almost presentations in a way that was different from kind of the previous subtypes. I wonder how that is going to interface. I wonder if, you know, dosage, you know, if we do get some more evidence-based and validated dosage tools that we start to train behavior analysts in. But I guess the end of the day kind of bottom line for me is like, we're going to have to remain really nimble as a discipline because it is going to change, and probably in a way that feels very scary. So much of our system is built on the 40-hour paradigm that not having it seems really scary. But I encourage people to think about the benefit that could have. And that, again, we're not saying that 40 hours is a bad thing necessarily, but just that these need to be more individually tailored recommendations.
That's kind of where I feel. Sorry, Lauren.
Yeah. No, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say that's kind of where I feel I'm at. Like, I don't think that we should be relying on you have to do 40 hours a week because that is the quote unquote gold standard. We shouldn't necessarily be looking at it from that perspective unless we truly feel that the client needs that level of support. And I will tell you, at least from my experience, maybe 95% of them don't get that support. But that could be just my experience too. We all come from different walks of life as behavior analysts. And I've seen optimal outcomes come from, you know, recommending less hours a week. Mm-hmm.
it doesn't make it any worse just because a client is not seen for 30 plus hours. It just means that we're individualizing, and it means that we're looking at not just, you know, the research, but we're looking at the child. And isn't ABA supposed to be individualized?
Yep. Isn't that what it's all about? That's the name of the game. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the subtype thing, Erica, because again, although this is new research and, you know, we don't have anything super distinctive yet, I do think that there is a general understanding in the field that there are different presentations, right? Right. And namely, you know, I'm talking about profound autism, mm-hmm. kind of compared to those with different presentations. And I want to make it clear, you know, Michelle, when you talk about like 95% don't need it, there are 5% who do. Mm-hmm. And they fall in that, usually that more profound category. And by prescribing hours to individuals who don't need the true 40, I think we're hurting those that do.
I agree.
And so I want to make that clear. Like, this isn't about, you know, we're not saying nobody needs this type of care or this level of care, right? Because I've seen those kids who need the intensive therapy. However, it has gotten overgeneralized. Mm-hmm. And so when we're prescribing that to kids who don't actually need 40, now we've given the whole field a bad name, mm-hmm. and it's hurting mm-hmm. the kids who actually do need it. So I think that is important to discuss as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to clarify that too. You know, I definitely am not saying like every single student should have no more than 30 hours a week. You know, I definitely do feel that, yes, like when it comes to like, again, it's going to kind of go back to medical necessity, but it also mm-hmm. too, like, comes from the level of support that they need.
Sure.
They need the higher level of support. Then absolutely, you know, looking at profound autism, looking at, you know, people with profound autism is definitely something that, you know, if they need the support, then we recommend the support. It's mm-hmm. not a one size fit all treatment at the end of the day. So, you know, our code tells us to do no harm. When we're making recommendations, we have to go back to our code. If we're going to make that recommendation and we're going to look at dosage, we want to make sure at the end of the day that we're providing the recommendation that is fit for them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well and said. I think we need to always remember that as our first and foremost motivation.
Yeah.
For sure. And we can probably, again, like put this on the agenda for next time, subtype discussion. Also just like levels of support, the language surrounding use of the term profound autism. I think there is a lot of very complex things to discuss there. But yeah, I think our bottom line, I think we all three very much agree on this. Like, we have to have tools that help us to make individual decisions, and we need to train our practitioners to make better clinical decisions and conceptualize cases better.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Well, kind of closing in on this, what would you recommend for, say, like a brand new BCBA coming in and they're being told, hey, by the way, you got to go assess this kid mm-hmm. and, you know, you have to come up with a recommendation all on your own. What kind of advice would you give that BCBA?
Yeah, I think that a lot of this conversation kind of goes back to assessment. And like, obviously, we have areas on the task list where it comes to, you know, becoming fluent in different assessment tools. I think seeking out as much professional development as you can when it comes to not only behavior analyst specific tools for assessment, but also things in psychology and development, those are just going to augment your ability, because these are also just decision-making tools. They're all just decision-making tools is what assessments are. The more that you can learn about, you know, different developmental assessments, the more you can get fluent in the VBMAP, the more that you can see kind of what other disciplines do. That's kind of, Lauren and I are always like, well, just go outside the field and like see what there's over there and then kind of bring that back in. I also think what you were saying, Michelle, about philosophical doubt, like don't be afraid to question that policy, and maybe not to your company, but, you know, at least to yourself, and in your decisions that you're making. I think that we are entering an era of, you know, we are going to be more and more under the microscope when it comes to insurance, and we are going to be getting more and more guidelines and recommendations from higher level companies and higher level organizations. We have to make sure that we are really getting quality case conceptualization. And for me, that comes in no better place than group supervision. So if you're in a program right now and you're not getting any kind of group supervision, that's definitely the place where I learned the most when it came to case conceptualization, for sure.
I would agree with everything Erica said. I think quality mentorship is really important. I think, you know, I would, and again, this is maybe not the most behavior analytic answer, but look at the literature on clinical judgment and on biases.
Yes.
Because doing some self-reflection so that maybe you can question some of your own decisions as you're looking at assessment data, to learn a little bit about, you know, do I potentially have a bias in this area that could be influencing the recommendation that I might make? And then just multimodal assessment, right? Never make a decision based on just one measure. You want to get multiple sources. You want to get multiple types of assessments, not just what, you know, the rating scale that mom and dad filled out, but also direct observation. All of that, you know, goes into that conceptualization as well as that clinical judgment piece. And then you've got your supervision and your mentorship. So it's quite a complicated puzzle,
web,
if you will. Yes.
Oh yeah, for sure. And honestly, like, so spot on what you guys are saying about everything between quality mentorship and, you know, seeking out multiple tools. And remember too, you know, for those of you who are becoming BCBAs or BCABAs, assessment tools are just a guide. Mm-hmm. They're not your clinical decision maker. It's just a guide.
Yeah. So important to remember. Yes.
Yes. Between that and then also too, like, you know, you're going to hear some people say, oh, well, you know what, my doctor said this, or, you know, my friend said this. And it's like, listen, you know, I understand that, but, you know, this is what we saw. This is, you know, this is the recommendation just based on all of these things that I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm one BCBA, and, you know, that's again, like you talked about case conceptualization earlier, it's really important to get as involved as possible, get yourself as, you know, for lack of a better term, like, studied up in a way, mm-hmm. just because
immersed,
again, because again, like, we want to look at the child as a whole, not mm-hmm. just, okay, this assessment says this, so therefore this needs to be the case. And mom and dad also said this. So, you know, like, we really have to put everything together, put all Absolutely. The tools together.
So. Absolutely. It's a tough agenda on this topic, for sure. But hopefully this at least gave some kind of search terms, guidelines, places to start, because I think we could probably keep talking about this for another hour or two.
We probably could, to be honest. We probably have to have yet another episode and we just talk about all the things. So, yes. But Erica and Lauren, thank you again for coming back to Safe Space. I am so happy that, you know, I got to speak to you guys about something completely different, but at the same time, I'm so happy that, you know, we got to have this conversation. I think it is just so necessary for our field right now.
Absolutely.
And couldn't have come at a better time.
For sure. Thank you so much for having us. We are happy to come on anytime. We just love chatting about all of this.
Yes,
for sure.
We do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, for those of you who didn't listen to the previous episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast, Lauren and Erica, where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, you can find us. The best place, the place we are most active, is our Instagram. We are at the Psychobabble BCBAs. You can also find us on our website, which is thepsychobabblebcbas.com. That's usually the best way to kind of get in touch with us. You can reach us at hello@thepsychobabblebcbas.com as well. So yeah, those are kind of the main avenues. We've got some fun stuff coming up in the next couple of months, and hopefully hopefully Lauren and I will work on our second book proposal next time we see each other.
And if you're interested in hearing us talk more about psychology and behavior analysis, you could definitely check out our book, Psychology Essentials for Behavior Analysts. You can get it on Amazon or through Routledge Press.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, thank you both so much for coming on again. I really could not tell you enough how much I appreciate it. Also, too, I also wanted to let you guys know that the episode that Erica and Lauren were featured on was back in August 15th, 2024. So season two, episode 11. Which is so funny because it was quite literally almost a year
ago. A year ago, yeah.
So how exciting is that? So if you want to listen to Erica and Lauren and I talk again, you know, refer back to the August 15th, 2024 episode. That's season two, episode 11, titled Exploring the Intersection, How ABA and Psychology Intertwine. Beautiful conversation on that episode as well as this one. And again, thank you, Erica and Lauren.
For sure.
Thank you.
And thanks so much, Michelle.
Yes. And thank you, everyone, for listening tonight. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will catch you on the next one. Bye, guys.